Transfer Wisdom. Transfer Wisdom is sponsored by Transformation, as well as others in our business community, Action Coach, as well as our leasing office here. We had to move here because they've now leased that big old space that we had here, but we still appreciate them because they keep the lights and the AC on. That's a good thing. Transfer Wisdom was created off of my platform that I believe that we should have a choice in our healthcare. And as I was visiting with people in the business community, I found that they don't know what holistic healthcare is. As a matter of fact, I belong to a CEO roundtable through the chamber and host it, and we take turns making presentations and promoting our business. And in doing so, it was right after our study that we did on leaky gut, and I was so excited to present. And I started right off saying, 63 days and you will no longer have leaky gut. And went on with my excitement, only for their eyes to be big and round. And finally, the senior in our group raised his hand. I stopped. Yes, Noel. And he says, what's leaky gut? So, what I know is, to have a choice in our healthcare, we must promote our holistic and integrative practitioners. And my opportunity was to invite lay people, those of us in need of holistic and integrative care, as well as practitioners, so that you can network amongst one another, and for you to be able to provide people with more information about what it is you do to help us all stay healthy. And that is the platform, very simple. It's an opportunity to get the word out. And so we're always looking for speakers, and if this is a platform that you practitioners would like to participate in, you just have to give one of my team members a heads up, because we do want to promote you. And now with our Facebook, we want to extend it to many, many more people, because this information saves lives, truly saves lives. And today, we are blessed with Dr. Nancy White. I want to say she's one of the smartest ladies I've ever known, and she's tons of fun, and she's a good friend and a mentor, but I also should tell you about her credentials. So Dr. Nancy White holds a doctorate in clinical psychology and is a licensed psychologist here in Texas. Married and a family therapist, she does all of that, plus is an addiction counselor. Certified, I believe, called Advanced AAC. She's recognized as a pioneer in the neurological sciences, and this is where I met her, is working with children with ADD and ADHD, but so much more now. She is a consulting editor for the Journal of Neurotherapy and contributing author to 2 college-level textbooks.
Five now.
And she obviously is a speaker too. As Sarah had mentioned, she Googled her name, and there she comes with YouTube videos and interviews on her belief that there is an alternative to changing brain chemistry and our brains that are non-pharmaceutical. And her son and I, Mark White, now the director of the clinic, have been working together because we have a heart for helping those that are broken. And we say broken in the world of addiction. And it really doesn't matter what kind of addiction in my book. No, it doesn't have to be alcohol or drugs. There are eating disorders, as many of us know. There's self-harm. There is addiction to negative thoughts, right, and behaviors. And we believe that addiction is a brain disease. And I know we were talking earlier, and I know how you know, I feel that you cannot heal the brain unless you heal the gut. But there's another component to it as well. And so Dr. Nancy White is going to be talking about an addiction model that is alternative to what we currently see. So help me welcome Dr. Nancy White.
Thank you. And I'm glad Leonard is our token male. Obviously, men don't want to know. I don't know what that says, but I think it says something. So it is really, it's not just that addiction hadn't plagued us for probably thousands of years, but it has really become a sort of forefront. And I was interested in just picking this up as we walked out, that last month's National Geographic has the science of addiction and talks about it being a disease, which I found interesting because that's a pretty conservative little magazine. It's interesting to me that everything I look at really nowadays has a brain on it. And 27 years ago when I got somehow piqued by brains, nobody was interested in brains but me, and they thought I was a real weirdo, and I probably was. I mean, it was just, every time I saw a picture of a brain, I literally felt excitement. And I didn't really know why, but it was just, I wanted to know everything about a brain. And nobody knew anything about a brain back then. And in fact, I am shocked to find that several medical male doctors have said to me recently, "You weren't taught anything about brains in medical school." And I'm thinking, you gotta be kidding. I mean, the brain is everything, it runs the show. And I have people who call and want to do an internship at our clinic, and they want to be psychologists and talk to people, you know. And I say, you can't come in my office while I'm talking to clients. This is not an agency, you know. And I said, but we've got lots of things you can do to understand the brain better and to be able to incorporate that in what you do every day with people. And I think, you know, if you're going to be a therapist, you really ought to understand brains. And it's like, like the guy that said, "What's leaky gut?" It's like, huh? No, you're kidding. So it's really been interesting to me, and I have people come in for marriage and family therapy, and they'll sit down, and usually it's she will start complaining about something, and he will look at her and say, "That was 10 years ago. Could you please let it go? You go over and over and over this." And I look at them and I know that she can't let it go because she's got a problem right here in her brain that is not functioning well, that we call the anterior cingulate. And it ruminates, and it holds on, and it doesn't move on. It's the gear shifter, except it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't shift gears. So I'm addicted to brains at this point. It's like I find them fascinating, and I find them far more important than most of us recognize. And people will say, "Well, it's just the way I am." And I'll say, it isn't the way you am, it's the way your brain is functioning, and it can be changed. And they don't know that. And a lot of the dysfunctional behaviors that we call personality, that we think are who they am, it's not. It's really how their brain is functioning, how the neurochemistry is functioning, how the blood flow is, how the energy is. You know, are they under aroused, over aroused, etc., etc. And it's neuroplastic. It can all be changed. So it's really been exciting and fascinating and wonderful to see how people can do things differently by changing their brain. So I'm going to see if I can move this work. Cause right now,
the arrow. You've got the pointer going.
I have two little arrows here. One goes right and one goes left.
Oh, so you're going to push the next one.
Punching. I've got a little, there's a little box here. Maybe that little box needs to go by. There you go. Now let's see if it works. That did it. Okay. So, what I want to focus on tonight is the brain having to do with addiction. And, you know, I come, which I'll talk about more later, but I come from a family of addicts. So when I was like 4 or 5 years old, I had an uncle, brilliant doctor, lovely, beautiful man, kind of remind me in appearance of Clark Gable. And he was a terrible addict. People adored him. He would go create this wonderful practice, but when in about 3 months, the phone would ring, and they always called my mother because she was the rescuer, and they would say, he's in jail. And she'd go get him out of jail for his DUIs. And back then, it was really interesting, which I'll talk about more in a minute. AA was different because it was pretty new. It was a long time ago. I was a little girl. And so what happened then was when you were an addict and you went to AA, it wasn't you just went to 90 meetings in 90 days, but you had a group of people. Usually there was about, and usually there were men, usually there were 4 to 6 men, and somebody was with you 24/7 so that they supported you not drinking and helped you through your craving parts. So it was a really different world back then, and a lot of the questions I had back then about addiction that I puzzled over when I was like 4, 5, 6 years old, I have since answered at this late stage of my life by reading all this material about brains. So now we really know that addiction is a disease. It's not a character defect. I mean, I think back about my uncle, who was absolutely brilliant. He loved music. He was very educated. He was wonderful. And he was a terrible addict, so he just kept ruining everything. So it's like my mother never lost faith, but that didn't fix it. So what we do is we have a craving and a withdrawal cycle that it is not all of us have this. I guess we can create it if we indulge in a drug or an alcohol or whatever long enough, we can create those neural pathways, but they're basically genetic. And they're related to an imbalance, mostly of glutamate in the nucleus accumbens, and I'll show you a picture in a minute of the nucleus accumbens and where it sits in the brain. And we have triggers that push us toward this addiction that we just forget there's a consequence. A consequence is just unimportant when you have that craving. And so we have genetic predispositions, and it's mostly a dopamine receptor gene, because dopamine is the real monster of this whole cycle of withdrawal and crave, and you just keep doing it and doing it, and it's like, just stop. And they can't just stop. It doesn't work that way. So this overall neurochemical balance is really the major issue of addiction. And let's see if we can work here. There we go. So drugs of abuse really target the brain's pleasure center. What? Did it not change?
Oh, it
went
changed
too far. There we go. Okay, so if you look in here, right in this center area, you see the frontal cortex, you see the nucleus accumbens, and the ventral tegmental area. Those are culprits of the brain in addiction. And the real abusive trigger of all of this is the dopamine. It's the reward chemical. And so as soon as we start getting these wonderful rewards, and if you are genetically predisposed to addiction, and then you find this wonderful drug that we could call even banana cream pie, or we could call it alcohol, or we can call it cocaine or methamphetamine, or you name it, they all affect this dopamine pathway. And as soon as that dopamine gets released, and the pleasure that is felt from that, it's like we're addicted, we're hooked, if you have the genetic tendency toward it. Those that don't are blessed. And I'll show you my family genogram in a minute, and how I've always said for all these years that everybody in my family is an addict but me and my mother. And I'll tell you about that one in a minute.
But you're addicted to the brain.
Yeah, that's right. But you know what's interesting? I didn't get addicted to the brain until I was way up in years. I didn't ruin my teenage years. it's really been interesting to watch all that evolve. And so what we've got here, if I can do it again, let's see.
There we go.
All right. We have a reward pathway that's the road to addiction. And the alcohol and the opioids increase that cell firing in that ventral tegmental area, which you see that down at the bottom here. And it releases that dopamine production, and it makes it available to the nucleus accumbens, and the nucleus accumbens just loves that dopamine. So the stimulants, they trigger the dopamine directly, and the nucleus accumbens releases that dopamine, and actually there's the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex here, which experiences and remembers pleasure. And when that gets triggered, consequences are just not even considered. The fact you're going to lose your business, lose your wife, lose your car, lose your money, it's like it doesn't matter because the pleasure overrides it all, which is, it's shocking. And those of us that aren't addicts, really, I don't think we'll ever understand it. I mean, I look at my family and my children and my father, and it's like it goes on and on and on. And you don't get it. It's like, just stop. And they can't and they won't. And I'll throw in another little piece here that's always bothered me, is because I know a lot of addicts, and they say, oh, well, you know, I think I have it all under control. You know, I can go and I can have a glass of wine. And it's like, yeah, that makes sense. And I can control it, and I can not get the second glass of wine. But the bottom line is, once you've stimulated and reminded that area of those neural pathways that respond to the dopamine, it's like, well, the first night it's one glass. The second night it might be one glass, but the third night it's probably two, and it goes on from there. Which then brings up the question that I've had since I was a little bitty child, when I hear these men in the other room talking to my uncle, and they would say, one drink from a drunk. And it's like, even at 5 years old, that didn't make any sense to me, because I knew one drink, you weren't drunk. And the fact was, what meant was, if you start drinking again, you might be able to have one drink tonight, maybe even one drink next week, but pretty soon you have reminded those neural pathways of what all this feels like, those pleasure centers, all that dopamine. And so it's truly like a disease. It is you're hooked. And it's you're hooked tragically. And these wonderful good people destroy their lives and destroy their families, and it is what it is. And so I'm glad that something like the National Geographic is finally putting stuff out there, because I can tell you, ever since I was a little child, it's still considered a character defect. And that's tragic, because it's really not. So one of the things that we need to do is start looking at, what's the story here? What's the neurochemistry here? How does this really work? So okay, I don't expect you to understand or even go into all of this, it's boring, but this is a gene test, and these are the major three gene markers. They are the dopamine receptor markers, and there are three main ones. And so, as you can see, the two top ones, the DRD1 and the DRD2, are more the addictive and compulsive ones. And then the third one down is what you frequently find in the ADD kids and me, and the hyperactivity, etc. It's not as closely associated with the alcohol addiction and the other substances. It's more of my observation of it, it's more behavioral. And
So I had the good fortune, have the good fortune actually, to have a dear friend, Dr. Kenneth Blum, and he never has gotten the acknowledgement of the fact that he and one other doctor worked for years to find what they call the phenotype of addiction. And he was the one that came up with the dopamine receptor genes. He's never mentioned, and it's really sad because he's written hundreds of journal papers, he's written two books that I know of, maybe more, and he talks about all this. So the interesting thing about having him as a mentor, as a friend, and so forth, one day he was talking and he said, I've got a family with four generations of addicts. And he said, I really have some theories about genetics and families and that kind of thing. And I really wish that I had another family, because I really like to consider, you know, kind of investigating deeper, and I want to do some articles on it. And I said, I volunteer, I've got five generations of addicts. And so back then it was really good because he was able to find someone that would do the gene testing at a very nominal price. And so I was able to do 23 members of my family. And it was very interesting because all these years I'd said, everybody's an addict but my mother and I. And sure enough, I got it back. And I had the least marker of anybody in my family. I had the bottom one, the ADD, ADHD gene, moderate, which is exactly what I would have told you. The other two were normal. And yet everybody else in my family had a mess. But what was really surprising is the worst one of my family was my mother. And I called Dr. Blum and I said, I don't get it, when I got all this back. And I said, she's the worst one. And I've always said, she's not an addict. And I said, you know, she was a chain smoker with cigarettes, but that's the only thing I know of. And I said, she got mad at my father's coffin and just put it out and never touched another one. He said, was she controlled and controlling? And I said, are you kidding? And he said, there's your answer. And what was interesting too is my mother, who died about, I guess, 10 years ago now, at 102, and was absolutely still going strong at 102, but her bones fell apart. And but what was interesting was that she was of the generation that the most important thing in life was what would the neighbors think. And she was not about to do any kind of behavior that somebody was going to negatively talk about her. So, you know, she was already gone by the time we did all of this. But sure enough, she was the one where it all came from. And I'll show you that one in a minute. But it was amazing because she was the caretaker of all the addicts of the family. And I mean, there were plenty of addicts in my family. Everybody was an addict. So here is one, the DRD1. This is a real powerful one. And you can see the list here of the behaviors that come with that one. And this is one of the major addictive ones of alcohol and drugs and so forth. And you can see the cocaine and the stimulant abuse and all of the negatives with that one. And then the next one falls in pretty much the same category. It's also the one that is more noticed with the ADD, the hyperactivity, etc. This is the one that I had moderate, where the other one, I was just perfectly normal with that one. So let's see here. Here is the list of all the behaviors that come from that first one. And it's actually the first one and the second one, which I didn't put up here, didn't show. that you can see how everybody you've ever known that's an addict, you can find them up there in that screen. And I can certainly go through there and put initials by most of those behaviors from my own family. So it's shocking what is really associated with these genetic markers, and tragic, because it's really where you got born. And you know, you didn't choose that one. And I really just feel so honored and blessed that I didn't have the mess that the rest of my family had. Now, it was a burden, it still is a burden on me, but let's see. Okay, so here's my family. And everybody in the family had the markers. And one of the things that Dr. Blum was interested in was the fact that he believed that if you had these genetic markers, you were more likely to attract someone that has the genetic markers. Then you're going to have children that have the genetic markers. And it just goes on and on from there. And that certainly proved to be the case. And I still just am puzzled over how fortunate that I was. So let me see here. All right. So what we're looking at here is what can we do about it? What, you know, all this is interesting to know it, but we don't want to live with all these addicts. And yet it is what we're having to deal with, because most addiction programs do not look at this whole background of neurochemistry and genetics, etc., and they don't address it. And you know, I can remember probably, let's say 27 years ago, I got interested in the brain, and one of the first things that I got interested in was a protocol that had to do with addiction and patients. And I, you know, thought that everybody was gonna be, you know, build this pathway to my doorway, because I had this wonderful new idea and thing and way of dealing with it. And so I go down to the Houston Council on Alcoholism and this whole big room full of people, and I go through all this, and it one more time, it was like these eyes looked at me like, what's a leaky gut? You know, what are you talking about? And I mean, I got no response in a room full of people that were either addicts themselves, and most addiction counselors are recovered addicts. So they were either looking at me from the point of view of an addict or the point of view of a counselor of addicts, and it's like, what are you talking about? Which was really, it was more than disappointing. It was very upsetting that here we have this enormous problem, and I certainly knew it was an enormous problem, because I tell people, I know a lot about addiction. I think I got started getting programmed at conception. I mean, it was just unbelievable to me, the pain and the suffering and the destruction that I had seen in my family, in my life, and certainly around me and my patients and everything, and no one was interested. It's like, so they sit around and they talk about it. Well, you can't talk about neurochemistry and really change it. You know, maybe over time a little bit, but not very much. So I kind of gave up on the Houston Council on Alcoholism, and I've never really tried again to go there. So one of the things that this talk is kind of an introductory to another talk that my son is going to do here at some point in the probably near future, because he is beginning a program of addiction recovery that we are addressing brain health. And as far as we know, there isn't really any other addiction program out there that the real focus is on brain health. And we have a lot of different ways we go about it. So one of the things that we're going to do is try to wake up the world and hope that they will begin to see that there are other ways of dealing with addiction in addition to 90 meetings in 90 days, which I don't want to put anything down, just because I think you have to address that emotional level of it, but you can't stop there. The emotional level, simply, you know, why do you drink? To escape pain. Why do you drink? To celebrate pleasure. I mean, you can't get around it. It is what it is. So let's see, where are we now? So we are really working to normalize the neurochemistry, and we come at it from the idea of a whole person, and a whole person with a brain, and a whole person with a brain with neurochemistry that is creating enormous problems, both for themselves and their families and everybody else around them. So we are working to normalize those glutamate levels in the nucleus accumbens, and to normalize the dopamine levels, and to rebalance neurochemistry in general. And there are many different ways. Standing here at Transformations, one of the things that we have really focused on, and one of the chapters in one of the books that we have had recently that published, is the brain-gut connection. Mm-hmm. If you don't address the brain-gut connection, you haven't got a complete picture yet. So we make a big deal about diet, and we do food sensitivity testing, and we do, we do micronutrient testing. We certainly encourage digestive enzymes and probiotics and anything that we can do to help that system become more balanced and healthier. And so what we find is that we can't do the whole program with food and that type of thing, but we can reduce a lot of the craving behaviors. And we also have a lot of technology. We work a lot with the brain. And I think that some of these here, I don't even remember. The next one here is a SPECT scan. And our SPECT scan, it shows you on the left-hand side, there is just a healthy control, and you can see the dopamine transporter, which is, I tried to turn mine off. You all did good, I didn't. So we have the healthy control, and you can see the little red with the dopamine transporter, and then you've got the drug abuser, I think a methamphetamine abuser. And you can see how it's not working very well. And then what's interesting is that this is that same guy. Here he is as here is a person that's healthy, and then here he is as the abuser, and this is after a month of abstinence, and here is one with 14 months of abstinence. So you can see there is some recovery. So that is that's helpful. We also, when you come into our office, one of the first things that we have people do is a quantitative EEG. It's a full cap EEG, eyes open and eyes closed, baselines. And that data is run against a reference database of a very large group of people with super healthy brains that have never had any kind of brain problem, not even chronic headaches. And then you are correlated with a group of people around your age. And then when it gets printed, you can see, this is not the best picture of it, but let me see if maybe I have a better one. I can't even remember. This little thing on the right is the quantitative EEG that we get on everybody, although it's, you know, we've got pages about that thick looking at it from every possible direction. But this is like the major piece there, that what we see is that with what we do, we can actually measure it. We measure the cue when they walk in, and we measure the cue along the way to see how are we doing, do we need to change protocols, etc. And then we measure it again before they leave. And they're major changes. The idea of that is a good healthy brain is all white. And you can see that has a long way to go to be all white. The blue is like very under aroused, the red is very over aroused. So let's see, the better, this one's a little better picture. If you look up there, so we're starting over here on the left hand upper side is, that is 1 hertz, and then 2 hertz, and then 3 hertz. So those first 3 are like dead asleep. That's the delta, and then it goes into the theta, and that's the ADD kids and a lot of ADD adults. And then we go into the alpha, and then we go into the betas. And those reds are frequently seen with anxiety. When you have a lot of red over aroused in the higher frequencies, you've got a lot of anxiety. And if I find it, the word that comes to mind is offensive, that we are just shoving drugs down these people because it is not going to fix the problem. It's going to create other problems. And I get in trouble from time to time. In fact, one of the big psychiatrists here, I was told recently that I'd offended one of our patients because I told her that she would really do better if she got off all this list of drugs, and that if she did our program, it probably wasn't going to have the effect she wanted. So she didn't like that a bit because she wanted her drugs. She's probably addicted to them. And so she went to this big psychiatrist, and if I told you the name of them, you would know it. And you know, so I've got the reputation of this being this real weirdo over there in that psychiatrist's office.
Yeah.
You know, Mark is offended by that. I am not overly offended. It's like too bad. You know? From a marketing point of view, he thinks that really sucks, but I'm there. It's like, I'm sorry, Mark. I just have to tell the truth. I don't know any other way to do it. So, anyway, the longer you're an addict, the more messed up your brain gets. And so, we don't have the row that shows what we call coherence, which is how the parts of the brain talk to each other, because that's how the brain functions, by talking to other parts of itself. And you can see with the red lines and the blue lines and so forth, some of them, it looks like spaghetti. And it's just that people will say, well, what's that going to create? And I'll say, it's not specific, it's functional. And you're just not going to be as functional as you're capable of being, or as intelligent as you are. And that begins to clear up. The beauty is that it really does clear up. So that has been really good. And then what we do is we look for things, particularly like amino acids, that are going to help balance the neurochemistry. We do the neuroscience neurotransmitter tests and that type of thing. And that gives us a great deal of information, and I find that their technicians are very helpful in sort of understanding the system of it. And one of the supplements that is excellent and we all need to know about is the NAC, the N-acetylcysteine. The NAC, it's a precursor for that glutathione, so it helps your immune system. But more than that, it really does make a difference in craving behaviors. And so anybody that comes in that's an addict really needs to be on a good bit of NAC. So we look for ways that we can work with things that are natural. And you know, one of the things that it's come up 3 times in the last 2 days, people on sleeping medications, and I keep telling them, you know, they'll say, but I can't sleep if I don't take it. And I'll say, you'll never be able to sleep as long as you're taking it. And it's really, it's scary. I've gotten 2 things on my email in the last 2 days about how sleep medications are really encouraging dementia. I really hadn't, mm-hmm. I, you know, it doesn't surprise me, but I really hadn't seen it just written, and just suddenly in 2 days I've gotten two whole things about this being creating this dementia. And then, you know, then kind of the question mark, maybe Alzheimer's, but they don't really go fully that far, but they do say it's clearly going to create a possibility of dementia. So,
did it change?
Yeah.
Too far, I
think. There was something wrong.
Yeah.
There. Okay, so what we can do is we can predict that the glutamate is going to eventually decrease with the NAC, the N-acetylcysteine. And so then we would expect to see the dopamine follow a similar pattern to the glutamate. Since the nucleus accumbens, glutamate can determine that dopamine output. So we have this whole system that goes, and just adding NAC every day is not going to fix it, but it's going to help it and it's going to make it better. So what we can say is if you change the brain, we're going to change the person. And it's pretty remarkable how the personalities in our office change of the patients that come in. I mean, they are really different when they come in and when they leave. And they're much nicer to be around when they leave than when they come in. So we can do the technologies that we've got the neurofeedback, we've got an incredibly sophisticated way of ascertaining protocols for how to train the brain with a full cap with neurofeedback. I mean, it has gone. I mean, when I started 27 years ago, you know, we had one electrode right here. We put it right here at the top of the head at what we call CZ. And I can tell you, it was amazing what we were able to create. But it took about 65 sessions. But nonetheless, it was pretty simple. And now it's a full cap, and I have a favorite story that you all would maybe even know her. You certainly know somebody in her family. But I had a woman come in, her family member had pushed her for about 4 years to get in because she couldn't drive on freeways, and she couldn't drive over bridges. And she was a very bright, very successful woman and had a good job. And she had to drive a lot. So she had to leave home about an hour and a half ahead of time in order to wander through residential areas to get where she needed to go so she didn't have to get on the freeway. And so finally, her family got her to come in. And so it obviously looked like anxiety. So about half the time that she came in, half of our program, we trained her with anxiety. And it was when we had another clinician who had worked in a lab for 2 years with this particular type of treatment. And so my assumption was he knew a lot more about it than I did. And on that level, he did. And he left and went to another state. And so suddenly I had to look at it. And so we do this full cap on her, and there's this long list of what we call a symptom checklist that's built from research and this brilliant neuroscientist that creates the software. He studies all this, and when he gets a particular areas of the brain that show up like in at least three different research projects, and he thinks the research is good research, those areas go in and they come on the symptom checklist. And so she comes in and she's been trained on anxiety, and she's better, she's much more calm, she's much more comfortable. She's still not driving on freeways and bridges. And I look at the symptom checklist, and for whatever reason, I see patterns. I'm always looking for patterns. And I look at this, and I'm thinking, vision, vision, vision. And I look over here, vision, networks, vision. And it's like, what's this about? And so I said to her, do you have a vision problem? She said, no, I don't have any vision problem. And it's like, okay. I thought, okay, well, maybe there's something here I need to pay attention to anyway. So I chose the one that felt most right. And it was really more felt right because I didn't have any data to go on except that I had about 15 different things on the symptom checklist and the network's checklist, it said vision. So we started training her, and we only had about two and a half, maybe 3 weeks more to go. And so at the end of that time, we had Ben, one of our clinicians, take Friday afternoon off, and they went riding. And they got in the car, and Ben was in the passenger seat, and she was driving. She got on the freeway, and she said, Ben, there are lines all down this road. He says, yes, ma'am. He's a military kind of person. He's always, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And you stay in those lines. Ben, that's amazing. Yes, ma'am. And then they go over a bridge. Ben, there's side to this bridge. There's a railing there. Yes, ma'am. And you be careful. Don't you hit that railing. Okay. What happened was she had a visual perception problem. And when she got on those freeways before we trained her, this area, they call it Broadman 18, right back here, it's part of the visual processing problem, and it's the part of the brain that sees edges and boundaries. And when she got on the freeway, there were no edges or boundaries. And she got on the bridges, there were no edges or boundaries.
Wow.
So she went into panic because it was like everything was like this. And she couldn't handle it. But she didn't know it. We didn't know it. But her brain knew it. It was amazing. And now she drives all over town. No big deal. Yeah.
So the retraining activated that part of her brain that wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
It was very specific to it. And don't ask me how it does it, because that's a part. I'm not an engineer, and I don't get how. I knew how we could train it on the surface, but I don't get how we're training it down and deep inside the brain. I don't get it. But we're doing it, and we've been doing it now for about 3 years, and it works. And to me, she was remarkable. And we've given her life back. She said, I haven't driven on bridges and freeways for 10 to 15 years. And I mean, her life was really restricted.
Now, do you have any idea how that part got passed over? Or?
No, and you never know. Most of the time, unless they've had a head injury and they know they had a head injury and they can, you know, like we can even do what we call a coup contre coup injury, like you hit your brain here and the brain bangs over here and hits over here, and that's the contre coup. So, you know, there may be a problem there, and that may affect, this could affect a social area. You know, suddenly you don't want to go out and be around people and all, because this is social. And you had this coup contre coup and you never even related it. So it's really pretty amazing how the brain functions. So we know that if we can change the brain, we can change the person, and that if we can change the neurochemistry and we can do all of this, that then we can affect addiction. That doesn't mean you're no longer an addict, because genetically and neural pathway wise and all, you are. But you can't go back and just say, oh, I can just drink a little bit, because the brain remembers. It's like, whoa, that was good. Let's do more of that. So it doesn't work. So we do a lot with supplements, and I just did this list of, these are just some of the things that we do for brain wellness. And one of the things that we do that Leonard really understands better than I, and that is that 5-HTP with B6, it's the whole methylfolate thing. And I really can't explain it to you, because I've never really fully gotten the concept of methylfolate. Dr. Merritt, who's our medical director, she's been talking to me about methylfolate and this methyl cycle and all for years, but it just kind of goes, I don't know why, it just doesn't work with me, with my brain. But what we find is that most of the people that have any kind of mood disorder or even addiction or whatever, they have probably got a methylfolate problem, and you really need to address that. So this is another just interesting story. This is a woman that I actually had years ago. She came in, her sponsor in AA called me and she said, I've got this sponsee that is, she's craving alcohol, since she was dry for years, and suddenly she started drinking again, and no matter what we do, we can't get her to stop. She's got this huge craving. Do you think maybe you could do something? And I said, maybe, probably, but we'll try. So she came in, and I'm telling you, she was a really bad craving alcoholic. She had a whole list of diagnoses. She had major anxiety and major anxiety attacks. She had an eating disorder. She was obese. She had a really heavy-duty depression, a lot of anxiety, but more than any of that, she had an emotional phobia. So it was really, it was when we didn't know as much then as we know now about addiction and our treatments and all that, but I was very comfortable in trying anything we had, because you were not going to get anywhere with talk therapy with her. Because as soon as you brought up anything that had any emotional content, she would either dissociate and you could just see her just go away, or she'd get up, literally walk out of the room and go away. And so we had to find a way to come around that emotional phobia. She had headaches, she had migraines, she actually had trichotillomania, and she pulled out all of her eyebrows and her eyelashes and her pubic hair. I mean, she was unbelievably dysfunctional and a nice person, but a mess. And so we started in on this treatment, and as she got into it, I don't remember how many sessions she had, she realized she had been sexually abused by her father as an infant in the crib, and she literally re-experienced that. And it answered a lot of questions for her, because she'd always hated her father, who was a medical doctor. And she'd come from, obviously, a very addictive family. And when she started looking at her family genogram and her history, her mother had died of alcoholism. Her father had dementia, but she hated him. And he was also an alcoholic. And she found out that her mother's brother had frozen to death on the front porch because he came home drunk and his parents wouldn't let him in. And it just went on and on. And we worked with her with all the tools we had. And she really got okay. She binged on food, etc. And so we did, back then we were doing a lot of, we don't do this much anymore just because it's time consuming and we know it works, but we did the MMPI, we did the Milan. And so this, let's see, the MMPI, when she started out, she was severe neurotic with an anxiety disorder, dysthymic disorder, and schizoid personality. The Milan said she had an axis 1 of dysthymia, axis 2 of borderline personality disorder, obsessive compulsive dependent personality disorder. I mean, she was literally a mess. And after we finished our treatment, we redid these, and she just came with a personality disorder without anything else there, and a psychoactive substance abuse disorder, which she definitely had. And all the list of personality disorders were just listed as histrionic. And it was interesting because the histrionic we saw as a real gift, because histrionic meant that she was much more emotional than she'd ever been. And for someone that was totally emotionally phobic when she came in, we saw histrionic as a positive. And the other one that she was high in at the very end was narcissistic. And one of the things that I noticed about the Milan is it really puts you into a dysfunctional category and assumes that you've got a lot of problems. And so a lot of the characteristics of a really well-functioning adult, if you list them as characteristics, they sound like maybe they're narcissistic. You know, I take care of myself. Well, they think that's narcissistic, you know. So I had the opportunity of, she invited me when she told her story in AA about 5 years later, she invited me to come. So I had the opportunity to see her and actually at that time ask her if she'd come in and redo the testing again, and she did, and it had helped. So all of these are just lines of the Milan and the MMPI. And so what we do is we're treating the whole person. And it doesn't matter whether you've got a traumatic brain injury, or you've got addiction, or you've got depression, etc. We have a full program where we address all levels as much as we can, and as much as you're willing, we address the levels of health and nutrition and brain function. And certainly at the top of the list, I would put brain function. So to me, tomorrow's formula for brain longevity are going to include a very individualized program with a lot of nutritional supplements and programs. And yes, we do the talk therapy, but that just kind of goes along adjunctively. That isn't the focus. And protocols to train the brain. We have many different ways that we can work with the brain, and a good diet and physical exercise and mental exercises, etc. And so that's what we do. And it's exciting, and it's fun to see people get better. Mm-hmm. Any questions?
Any questions? So talk to us a little bit more. I love the idea. We talk about our physical fitness and exercising, and we talk about nutrition, but the idea of exercising the brain and looking at the brain as the brain health, talk to us a little bit more about what that means, especially with, we all have patients that get stuck, and this is a great place I know to go to on repeating the same habits, are not being able to break away, regardless. So how are you stimulating the brain? What does that mean?
Good question. We have a new technology, and I say new, after 27 years, 7 years seems new. But it's a new technology called Anexolin, which is a transcranial electrical stimulation. And by electrical, it's a frequency that you can't even feel. It's hardly more than your battery in your watch, and it puts in a frequency into the brain. It resets the hypothalamus in the brain, and I can tell you the hypothalamus is far more important than you were ever taught.
It's not, can anybody do that?
Huh? Yeah.
Absolutely. That sounds like fun.
It is. In fact, this afternoon, I, for whatever reason, I managed to wake up at 5 o'clock this morning, and I didn't go to bed till late, so I had not had enough sleep. And so I thought, I can't go talk to people. My brain is like fuzzy. And so I went in and did the Nexolin, which is the name of the technology. And it's very good for the immune system. It rebalances a lot of the neurochemistry. The first year we had it, we would do it as a standalone because we wanted to see what the next one did. Now we combine it with everything else that we do. And that's sort of our foundation when people come in and they do the quantitative EEG and the IVA, which is a computerized test of auditory and visual attention. And we do a whole, what we call an FAQ, which is functional assessment questionnaire of symptomology questions. We work with a doctor that said, don't treat symptoms, find the cause, but the symptoms will probably take you to the cause. So we do all of that, and then we start with, we ask people to do 10 sessions, one every day of the Nexolin. About 5 sessions, we start adding other things to it, but our program is totally individualized, with the exception of the fact that everybody that has a hypothalamus, which is everybody, the homeostatic frequency of the hypothalamus is 77.5 hertz, and that's, if you're human, that's it. And so that is not individualized, that's just what is. And then we add to that all the full cap, the full cap training, where we, and I can't tell you what's going on in there, but we can put the program into the computer and tell the computer what we want to do, like in this woman with her visual processing problem. The computer software knows how to do it. It's gotten way beyond my brain's comprehension to it. And these are the engineers that, it's amazing to me what they've created. So it is literally training that brain with those protocols, and then about every 8 sessions we do another quantitative EEG and get a whole new symptom checklist, and then give them another protocol and go through that. So that is, we have a program of 25 sessions. 25 sessions doesn't mean 25 treatments. It means every time you walk in our office, we call that a session. And you may get one thing, you may get 2 things, you may even get 3 things sometimes. We have another technology called neural field, which is an electromagnetic therapy. And put this little cap on with little magnets. I don't understand how that works either, but it works. And it's pretty, that's pretty amazing. We even have an ocular light therapy that really got me started with the brain about 30 years ago. And it is, it's pretty fascinating because it, again, light comes in the eyes, goes down the optic nerve, and goes to the suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus gets itself involved one more time. And this optometrist, who had been the president of the School of Optometry, created this, but he was ahead of his time. And so he was not very successful as far as marketing it, because everybody, like they thought I was crazy, thought he was crazy too. And so he didn't sell many, so his backers pulled all their money, and so he couldn't do that. So it was interesting. I was going through a well. I've always been a little ornery, even from here. So I was going through the internet looking for something, and this thing pops up, and it talks about chronotherapy, and I'm thinking, what is chronotherapy? So I start investigating, and here's this machine that it looks like a really crude version of what I've got, and I go, where is this coming from? This looks like a light machine. And I go, and it's Columbia Medical School. So apparently the medical world is beginning to wake up again. I mean, you know, we used to use light and color several thousand years ago with the ancient Egyptians and so forth, and now they're beginning to see it does, it might have some merit. So it's that, and we do a lot of testing, and we do a lot of nagging, and that's kind of our program. Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend people doing things at home? Do you give them anything to do at home?
Not really.
At all? No? Just,
I mean, eat right, and that.
Well, I mean that for sure, but I mean,
that's
any
the
type of mental exercises or anything, you don't recommend any
crossword puzzles.
Really don't need to. That's not, because that really doesn't have that much effect. I mean,
because yours is more high tech than anything they could ever do at home.
Uh huh. Because it's much more powerful, and you know, you can tell people think positively and be so negative, but the fact is, once the brain starts getting in better balance, it's a natural outcome. So you don't have to tell them. They just start doing it. It's really quite amazing. Anybody else?
Awesome.
Okay, well, I really thank you.
There is some information up here, and of course, I think it'll stay for a little bit now that we actually have something to eat. But they're on the technology that she's talking about. She's got some information up here as well as a couple of their programs, too. So definitely grab that. I know that Leonard, who stepped out, has worked with a lot of children.
He works a lot with autistic kids.
Autistic children. So if you want some more information on that as well, visit with Leonard, because he loves his kiddos, is what he calls them.
Yes.
So definitely get with him afterwards too. And thank you very much again.
Thank you.